This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I will be talking about fall prevention strategies. So for today, we'll really review exactly how common are falls in older adults. Really, older adults we've considered sort of 65 years and older. Really, what are the consequences after a fall? What are the risk factors, both kind of personal and environmental risk factors for falls? And then really the bulk of the talk is about what are the evidence-based strategies and interventions that can prevent falls. So as you all might guess, the frequency of falls increase as we get older. This is just some data from the CDC here, but you can even see from 65 to 74, it's about 27% people have reported a fall, and after 85, that has increased to 37%. There are numerous of reasons why falls increase as we get older. A long laundry list of things such as decrease with sort of our reflexes, our strength in our legs are not as, is not as good as we used to be when we were young. As we get older, we're probably taking more medication, so there's side effects to those. And also just, especially with the aging population, we have more comorbidities, so say diabetes, arthritis, all of those things can contribute to increased risk of falls. So exactly how common are falls? Some of these numbers are actually pretty staggering. One of CDC had cited an older adult falls every second of every day. There have been numbers where one in three people over 65 years old living in the community, so living in the community is living in your own home, fall each year. And then for those that are living in, say, nursing homes, it's almost as high as 50%. So, as all of the population continues to get older, as you can imagine, this is starting to become a growing burden on medical care and people's function. So they even said in 2014 there was about 29 million falls, and this projected up to 2030 would rise to 49 million falls. As the population ages, obviously this will increase, and they've also estimated that the medical expenses for the fall costs over $31 billion. So, worst case scenario, of course, after a fall, a lot of things can happen. Things that we worry about would be fractures, some sort of soft tissue injury, dislocations, and brain bleeds or, hemorrhages to the brain. It's been said that about 1 in 10 falls in older adults in the community resulted in one of these major injuries. So they considered a major injury either a fracture, head trauma, or like a major laceration or a cut. They say about 1 in 3 of older adults in nursing homes have falls that result in a major injury. And then falls accounted for over half of injuries leading to emergency department visits in the U.S. And it's really been cited as the leading cause of non-fatal and fatal injuries in adults greater than 65 years old. So with other lectures, I'm sure you've heard this with this course, a lot of things that we're worried about are fractures. So sort of what we define as a fragility fracture is basically minor trauma that results in a fracture, so that normally shouldn't cause that sort of injury in sort of normal, healthy bone. So risk factors for this would be low bone strength, sort of also what we consider, say, with osteoporosis, and then also another risk would be increase in risks of trauma like a fall. So 1 in 10 falls in the elderly result in a fracture, and this is more often in women. This also can be related to the fact that there are higher rates of osteoporosis in women, and then actually I'll discuss later women have a higher rate of falling compared to men. And then falls are actually the number one cause of hip fractures, and these are falls even just from a standard height with no other sort of external trauma. So we use this term a lot in medicine, morbidity, but falls can lead to increase in morbidity. So what exactly is morbidity? That's sort of the state or condition of being diseased. So it's been shown that after someone falls, obviously they have a decline in function. For hip fracture patients in particular, they've cited anywhere from 25 to 75% do not recover back to their functional status before the fall. And it's sort of thought that this, you know, injury likely led to a net deconditioning that basically occurred during this recovery period. Another thing, too, is with falls, obviously, it can lead to a fear of additional falling, and that can lead patients to not want to do as much exercise or move as much. There's also an increased likelihood of going to nursing homes and then a greater use of medical services. So these are just some of the risk factors that have been cited. So personal risk factors, obviously older age, like we were talking about. Female gender, actually, just when amongst many studies, it actually showed women fell more than men. The thought was that it might have to do with falls with multitasking, and actually that women might actually have a variation in their gait pattern during like dual tasked activities. And women actually tended to have more falls inside the home, in the kitchen, and while performing household activities. Low muscle mass, obviously, decreased strength in the legs, those are risk factors. A lot of these are sort of, as you know, as you would guess, so balance problems, poor vision, problems with cognition, low blood pressure when standing. We also call that orthostatic hypotension. So if you go from sitting to standing, your blood pressure doesn't really respond as fast, so you might feel lightheaded and have a fall. Use of certain medications. So this can be, we call them psychotropic medications, but ones sometimes that help with sleep and anxiety and depression. Common ones are, say, benzodiazepines or Valium, people might have heard of, or antidepressants like amitriptyline. Those are ones that really have been cited to have increased risk of falls. And then various musculoskeletal and neurological conditions. So arthritis and severe pain associated with arthritis has been linked, and then neurological conditions, say if you've had a stroke or Parkinson's disease. And then environmental factors, so these, as you would imagine, maybe slippery or uneven floors, rugs, poor lighting, slippery surfaces. So if it's not obvious enough, obviously there's numerous reasons why we should reduce falls, let alone for the injuries, obviously the hospitalizations, fall-related death, and decline in function. So can we prevent falls? So that's a yes, otherwise this would be a very short lecture. So what can we do exactly? So given that there's certain things that we can't really change, really there's good evidence out there to focus on things that we can change. So there's physical inactivity, your home environment, medication use, poor vision, and then fear of falling. So a lot of this, so the next several slides is really based on multiple studies. There's a Cochrane review that came out, which really helps analyze multiple kind of high-quality studies out there in our field of medicine. So the next recommendations are really based on that. So exercise was really shown to be the single best modification to reduce falls. Exercise that includes strength, balance, flexibility, and endurance. And really they say if you include any of these two, that really has been shown to reduce fall risk. If you've had a fall, they say that working on strength and balance are really important. And this helps reduce risk of falling if you've never fallen, and also your number of falls. So if you're not exercising or you are exercising, it's shown to be beneficial for both groups. And both group and home-based exercises have shown to be helpful. And really, I think the key is to talk with your doctor or physical therapist before starting an exercise program to find the best fit. It's sort of recommended 3 hours a week are found to be the most effective. And we'll talk about more on exercise in the next lecture as well, generally speaking. But one type of exercise that's been really actually well studied is Tai Chi, which is, you know, the ancient Chinese martial arts practice. So this contains elements of strength and balance, and it actually shown to reduce rate of falls by 43% in 1 year. And really, I think another key with exercise is that it helps make you aware of your body and your surroundings, and also can decrease your fear of falling by going through a lot of these movements. So I'll talk about falls in the home. There's really two sets of groups that I saw in the literature. Most falls in the home are the ones that did result in these fragility fractures, especially if you're over 80 years old. Less frequent were falls outside, and usually those were in more active, active adults that were, say, walking with a really fast speed. So really I'll focus mostly on falls in the home. So people can see this picture if they can kind of see the various problems with what's going on. So just to highlight a few, so I mean, even there's the footwear, wearing slippers, stairs without handrails. You see, I mean, boxes on the stairs, that's very high risk. And then they're kind of showing the medication cabinet, which can be, a sign of polypharmacy or multiple medications that might be causing an increased risk. Yeah. You can see the rugs sort of not well fastened to the ground, so that's just an example. So modifying your home has been shown to reduce number of both falls and risk of falling. This was by about 40%, the number of falls, and risk of falling by 25%. So examples would be, removing these loose floor mats, painting edges of steps so that you can see the steps better when you're walking, reduce any glare, obviously, yeah, grab bars, stair rails, removing clutter, improving lighting. And really the best results were shown when the safety evaluation was done by an occupational therapist. So here's are just some examples of what we talked about. So moving outside the home, footwear. So footwear is very important. They've shown that footwear that fits poorly, shoes that have worn soles, high heels, or shoes that are not laced are associated with a higher risk of falls. One study did show anti-slip shoes reduce the rates of falls in icy conditions. We don't have to worry about that here, luckily. But if you have chronic foot pain or chronic foot condition, say that you see a foot doctor for a podiatrist, performing foot and ankle exercises has shown to reduce risk for falls as well. And then they had one study where they actually looked at patients in the hospital that were just wearing these anti-slip socks, and actually they showed that these did not help prevent falls, and that really the best thing to do if you were an inpatient in a hospital is to wear your own home personal shoes. So another strategy that is shown to be very effective is minimizing certain medications. So there are some medications that put people at increased risk of falls. Obviously, these are some that can increase or affect your mental state. So like I had mentioned, the benzodiazepines, ones treat for antidepressants or common drugs, they basically can make you feel very groggy or confused at higher doses. Too many medications or even blood pressure medication sometimes if they make you feel lightheaded. But really the evidence showed that gradual removal or lowering the dose of certain of these medications for improving sleep, reducing anxiety, and treating depression were shown to reduce the rate of falls. So then just a few other interventions. I know these are a little bit more specific, but there's one entity that's called carotid sinus hypersensitivity. Basically, our receptors for certain people tend to be very sensitive with change in position and activity. So if you see a cardiologist for this condition, getting a pacemaker is shown to reduce the rate of falls. Postural hypotension, so that's the decrease in blood pressure going from sitting to standing. Treatment of that, they've said, abdominal binders, stockings, even making sure you're well hydrated has shown to help prevent falls if you have that condition. And then if you have cataracts, actually early surgery for the first time or the first eye is shown to reduce the rate of falls, but it hasn't been so helpful for your second or other eye. And then there's been a lot of studies on vitamin D, but really based on the most recent literature, The most that we can say is if you have low vitamin D levels, vitamin D supplementation may reduce your rate of falls. But it wasn't, you know, a slam dunk, you know, sort of answer that we saw in the literature. But, you know, if you see your doctor, you do have low vitamin D levels, sort of the recommended dose is around 800 to 1,000 units daily. And if you don't have low vitamin D levels, the supplementing hasn't been shown to sort of prevent that. And they actually had some studies where they had patients take very high doses of vitamin D, and there were certain scenarios where that actually increased their risk of falls. So, you know, and we always talk about sort of checking your vision and making sure you get that assessed. I think it's important to be careful after certain eye treatments because actually one study shown a 57% increase in fall risk immediately after, say, new eyeglasses or ophthalmic treatment, which might sort of reflect sort of this transition period. So, you know, I'm sure everyone knows this, but if you do fall, try to stay calm, check to see if you're hurt, call for help, whether it's with a telephone or by just calling out to see if anyone's around. If you think you can get up, do it safely. If you are hurt, I do not recommend, you know, it's not a good idea to try and get up. And then obviously see your doctor, seek medical attention if you've hit your head. This is sort of one recommendation of how to sort of get up safely. So they say, you know, roll onto your side, make sure you sort of adjust to your change in position and blood pressure, crawling over to like a sturdy chair, and then basically lifting one foot at a time and putting your weight over the chair, and then sit down before trying to move anymore. So, you know, things that we can even start by doing right now with your doctor. So, you know, if you've had a fall, if you're afraid of falling, or feel like you have difficulty with balance, that's important to tell your doctor. Reviewing your medications, especially if you have many of them, or using, say, ones for sleep or depression. Getting your eyes checked yearly is important. Check your cardiovascular status. And then really a plan that's individualized to you is better than sort of a general plan. So what your partner or your friend might be doing would be different for you. And even now, things say tonight, you know, standing up slowly so you can let your blood pressure adjust, assess your home for hazards, avoiding excess and tobacco. You know, obviously there's increased risk of falls with alcohol use, and actually chronic tobacco use has been associated with falls. Your shoe wear. There actually hasn't been great data on whether canes or walkers have been helpful. It's really important, though, if you do have a device to make sure you're using it properly. And then exercising with guidance. So this was actually from the CDC. Even if you just Google steady STEADI, that's sort of the CDC's fall prevention strategy. Here's a checklist of things that you can look at for your home, from in the kitchen to the floors to the bedroom. And then this is a great website that is out there. It's with the National Council on Aging, but basically you can help find evidence-based fall prevention programs in your area, whether it's Tai Chi. Some of these are various examples that, you know, also vary on your functional level and your age as well. And then here's just sort of more information on what I discussed. And that's it.
Hi, my name is Masato Naga, one of the physiatrists. This is a different computer that I made slides a little bit differently. So my topic is exercises, are they effective? So when I see the patient in the clinic setting, there are a bunch of questions about the exercises, but these three are mostly commonly asked. Question one is, I am too old to start exercising. Question two, exercise put me at risk of falling. Question three, I can't exercise because of the pain. These are the questions for most of the patients ask. So according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Center for Disease Control and Prevention, U.S. people will be inactive at age 75 in 33% of the men and one half of the women. So if you are not active, what happens? So muscle strength with no movement, 10 to 20% is muscle strength is declining every week, and 50% decrease in 3 to 5 weeks. So bone density, so if you are 12 weeks bed rest, 50% of the bone density is decreased. So left side is a photo is a normal bone, and right side is osteoporotic bone. So aerobic capacity, this is endurance or cardiopulmonary function. That is measured by VO2 max, which is the maximum oxygen the body can use. If no exercise, 10% is decreasing in 2 weeks, 15% in 4 weeks, and 20% in 3 months. How about metabolism? So if no activity, fat increase 15% in 5 weeks. Psychosocially, if no activity, many people get depression, anxiety, and stressed out. So among the body system that briefly mentioned about these things, but other than these, neurologically, GI system, urinary, skin, endocrine, and joint, most of the organs are affected by no activities. And by these multiple organs are affected, you may die younger. So it is important to be active. So in the United States, this is a regular activity, not for the sports activity or anything. So average U.S. people steps around 5,000 steps, which is equal to the 2.5 miles. So how about the other countries? So Switzerland and Western Australia is nearly twice as U.S. people, and Japan is also 1.5 times more than the U.S. people. So NIH and AARP made a study. AARP, some of them already are involved in the American Association of Retired Persons. So they mailed to in 1995 to 1996 for initial survey to age 50 to 71. These are the several states and some big city, metropolitan cities. And then 8 or 10 years later, they mailed to the same people to the follow-up survey. So they found watch TV 5 hours per day and physically active less than 3 hours per week. In 10 years, many people get trouble walking. On the contrary, sitting less than 6 hours per day and physically active more than 7 hours a week, even 10 years, they keep on the good mobility and no disability. So that physically active is very important. So these are the kind of a functional scheme. Age 30 to 35, many people keeps good function level. And by aging, the function level is declining. So if you are active, this is inactive. So let's say age 70, so in the younger age, there is almost no difference, but by aging, so active people or inactive people is huge difference for the functional level. So let's say this is a disabled level, so lower function level gets disabled. So in the the black line is a kind of average people. It's maybe disabled in 85 or 90 years old. Active people still pretty good, higher above the disabled level. However, the inactive people, even in the around the 60 or 65, they get disabled. So physical activity is what we do in the daily act, daily life, like gardening, walk with dogs, going up and down steps, and cleaning the home. And also, exercises is part of the physical activity. The difference of the exercise is it is planned, structured, and repetitive. So there is a study pick up the age 75 to 85, 700 women, divided to two groups, almost the same number. So one group give a supervised group balance training once a week. The other one, nothing. In 2 years, they showed reduced falling and improved functions. Control probably is declining by age. So this is the same scheme that I showed. So disabled, even begin exercise, even in the different age group, there are some benefits. How about a pain patient? This is one of the patients who has low back pain. So this is a side view. What do you see? This is a normal person for the scheme, for the weight bearing portion is towards the center, and the lumbar part there is some curvature, and the knee is straight out. However, this patient has a little bit weight line is a little bit going forward, and the lumbar part is straight, and the knee is flexion, like a bending. So these are the part of the cause of the pain. So for our point of view, as a rehab physician, we do exercise to stretch out the back muscle and stretch out the hamstring muscle to make a knee straight. So this is this year's published this year for low back pain patient, average age 61, divided to two groups, and they give back exercises. It's 2 times a week for 5 weeks. So one group, it's added aerobic exercise. So after the back exercises, they additional station bike for 15 minutes. So the results are aerobic exercise group improve pain and disability. So that this is not only for the back part, for the pain part, but overall, including aerobic exercise, makes the pain or functional level is improved. So what kind of exercise is recommended? That is Dr. De Rosario's slide mentioned, like 4 points. One is aerobic, strength, balance, and flexibility. So aerobic exercise includes walking, jogging, dancing, swimming, and biking. Strength exercise includes push-up, weights, and elastic band, so on. Balancing exercise, toe heel stand, that is left side of the scheme, and leg side raising in the middle of the scheme, and squat. And also Tai Chi and Yoga is also good for the balancing exercise. Flexibility includes stretching and joint mobility. Now, how strenuous, like how do we know the intensity of the exercise? There are a bunch of measures, but these two are simple and easy to use. One is torque test, second, target heart rate. So torque test, during the physical activity, if you can talk, that is kind of a moderate, or maybe mild or moderate intensity. But if you are too high breath up and you can talk, you can say only a few words, that is a level is vigorous activity. That, so that these are the, not the definite measure. That is, everyone is different. Some of the very higher level of capacity, their vigorous activity is very, very high level. But some of them just started the exercise. That is different. So that, but this is based on your physical or physical response. So second one is target heart rate. These target is 50 or to 85% of the maximum heart rate. So maximum heart rate is calculated by 220 minus your age. So let's say for the lower part, if you are 70 year old, so 220 minus 70, which is 150, is your calculated maximum heart rate. And 50% is 75, and 80% is 132. So if you are just started the exercise, maybe target rate is nearly 50 or maybe 60% of the maximum heart rate, and getting more and more, and you are kind of an experienced exerciser, now that go to the 75 to 85% of the maximum heart rate. So U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommend over age 65, they recommend aerobic and strength exercise. If you do moderate exercise, 150 minutes per week. It is two hours and 30 minutes. Or if you are doing a vigorous level, that is a 1 hour and 15 minutes per week. And not either. And strength exercise more than twice a week. That is a recommendation for elderly people. So this slide is I showed in the earlier part of my presentation. Question one, I'm too old to start exercising. Question two, exercise put me at risk of falling. And question three, I cannot exercise because of the pain. So answers are, it is not late to start exercising. Answer two, exercise reduce the risk of falling. So do not fear of falling. So you can do starting the mild exercise to increase it. And answer three, exercises, proper exercises reduce the pain. So this is a final scheme, final talk, that the exercises, are they effective? So everyone knows it's yes. And independent and happy life. Thank you very much.
I'm going to be talking about post-fracture protocols and are they different in the elderly. First of all, we're going to be going over the following fracture protocols in the elderly. We're going to talk about the extent of the literature. Then we're going to switch over and focus to epidemiology of hip fractures. We're going to be looking at something called the Geriatric Fracture Center, which I'm going to say equates to the accelerated care model, to the enhanced care model. More on that soon. Also, we're going to be addressing whether early surgery following a fracture is better, particularly specifically for a hip fracture, and also then just to summarize after that. So when you look at PubMed or you Google and try to find out anything about specialized protocol for elderly after a fracture, you'll see a little bit of information on rib fractures. You'll see a little bit on upper extremity fractures, but not really protocols that are used that are used a lot in different centers. You'll see a lot more information about cervical spine fractures, though, but it's mostly going to be centered around the growing awareness of the morbidity and mortality related to cervical spine fractures, but not so much on the use of certain protocols that are being used at different hospital centers. What you will see a lot of, though, is a lot of information about hip fractures, and that's sort of in keeping with the theme of fall prevention and exercise. We're going to see a lot on hip fractures, so that's what we're going to focus on. And the important thing to notice here is why, is because the incidence of hip fractures per year is about 350,000 hip fractures per year. While the incidence has decreased, the prevalence, that is the number of people who have a hip fracture at any given time, is expected to grow to about 500,000. And then worldwide, this is a crazy number when I saw this, by 2050, albeit it's about 30 years down the line, the number of people with hip fractures will exceed 6 million, and it's noted to reduce life expectancy by 25%. And the cost is staggering at $37 billion by the year 2040. So really, it's something that's important to note. The challenge with treating people with hip fractures, though, is that a lot of people who are older have multiple comorbidities, and Dr. Del Rosario talked about comorbidities or morbidities. So that's related other illnesses that may be occurring at the same time, like heart disease or heart failure, arthritis, diabetes, hypertension, things like that that may be happening at the same time when somebody has a hip fracture. A lot of patients, elderly patients, are at risk for developing delirium, either due to infection or due to drugs they were taking before their fracture, or the drugs we throw at them after they're fractured that result in delirium. Also, you're at increased risk of infection. You may be immunocompromised, maybe because of diabetes or other illnesses you may have. There's increased risk of pneumonia because you're not moving after your fall. You're having pain. You're not breathing deeply. You can have potentially pressure ulcers because once you have a fracture, you're not moving around in the bed as well as you were before. So you could develop injury to your skin. Blood clots also related to immobility and bleeding. So there's a lot of different challenges that we have to meet when in thinking about treating patients with hip fractures. So what's the thought about? What do we do about these? How do we meet the challenges of treating elderly individuals who have hip fractures? And one of the kind of models of care that people are looking at nowadays is related to a geriatric fracture center. Or in some places, it's called accelerated care. Or in other centers, it's called enhanced care. So I'm going to be using that terminology sort of interchangeably. And what does it entail? Well, basically, it has all of these elements, and we're going to talk first about them individually. But really, it's a program to help minimize, in theory, the complications and morbidity related to somebody having a hip fracture, coming into the hospital, and hoping to treat them so they remain as healthy as possible during their hospital stay, and of course after. So what's very important in having a center that really addresses this approach is to have a multidisciplinary team approach. And that means that everybody has to be on board, from the orthopedic surgeon to the social workers, to the dietitians, to the radiology techs that may be involved in patients' care. And the important thing here is that you really need leadership, particularly they point out in the literature, to the orthopedic surgeon co-managing patients with a geriatrician. So a geriatrician is typically an internal medicine doctor who does extra training in the care of elderly individuals and is more acutely aware of potential complications with too many medications or blood pressure, things like that, that may impact a patient's recovery. But it also means that if you have a center like this, you have to have an emergency department staff that recognizes this is super important, this is something we have to address right away, the radiologist has to be on hand right away to read the films, the anesthesiologist has to be present in the operating room and ready for you for surgery, the nursing staff has to be there, and social workers. Now, in a center like UCSF, a lot of that is really readily available. But if you think about if you're in a more suburban community or a rural community and you're at a community hospital, you may not have access to these individuals right away. The other thing is that's really important is also looking at standardized order sets and protocols. Basically, these groups get together and they say, what should we, when you get admitted to the hospital, or if we're going to admit you to the hospital, what important things do we have to remember? We should have some standard order sets so we make sure we don't forget any particular aspects of a patient's care. For example, let's make sure we order the right labs. Let's make sure we try to order the right pain medications. Let's make sure that we make sure that we prevent pressure ulcers. So there are standard order sets. There are also protocols that may be in place for pain control. Let's try to minimize the use of opioids or narcotics. Let's try to prevent delirium by really closely looking at an individual's medication list from home and making sure we're not missing anything. And then whatever we throw on top of that because they're in the hospital, let's make sure that we're giving the proper doses and not combining medications that may make them more prone to change in mental status. In addition, being aware that there's a protocol for potentially helping pain out not through oral medications but through direct nerve blockade that may help to minimize pain and minimize the amount of medications a patient is taking. The other thing we want to make sure is let's order the right labs. So that would be to assess for dehydration. Maybe it was dehydration that actually caused the fall. Or maybe they fell, and then because they were on the floor a really long time, they're now dehydrated. Or let's make sure that they don't have a urinary tract infection. Maybe it was a urinary tract infection that caused the fall. Because sometimes when patients are elderly and they have a urinary tract infection, they have a change in their mental status, and maybe that contributed to the fall. And if somebody has an infection, we want to know about it before they go into the operating room. So we want to make sure we cover all our bases before somebody, when somebody is admitted to the hospital. The hardest part in a lot of cases that that hospitals face is having the patients cleared from a medical standpoint for surgery. So basically, if you're somebody who comes in and you have multiple medical problems, heart problems, you're on anticoagulation or blood thinners, and all of these different things going on at the same time, you might be somebody that somebody might not want to rush right to surgery. And you might want to have a consultation by a geriatrician or a cardiologist to make sure that you're cleared from a medical standpoint for surgery. And if you can think about it in a rural setting, you may not have a cardiologist that's there right on hand to do this in an expeditious fashion. Or if the cardiologist decides they want to order an echocardiogram or a picture of your heart to see how your heart's doing, or something like that, that may not be readily available in a smaller hospital. In addition to protocols, we want to make sure that you have modalities to prevent pressure ulcers. So this may not immediately come to mind, but if you're at a center that really kind of looks at protocols and standard orders, we want to make sure that people have the right things to prevent pressure ulcers. It might mean special splints to put on the foot to prevent pressure ulcers to the bony parts of the feet. It may mean turning somebody every 2 hours to make sure that they're shifting their weight constantly. It may mean putting a mattress overlay to try to prevent skin breakdown. Also, you want to order the proper laboratory evaluations. Parathyroid hormone and thyroid hormone, they all contribute to bone health and bone metabolism, as well as calcium and vitamin D. So you want to make sure that somewhere during your hospital course this is checked, just in case somebody needs supplementation. And they found in studies that lots of people are either not on supplementation or they're taking it inconsistently. Big in the jargon nowadays is early mobilization programs, and you'll find this in the medical literature about how important it is to get people up and around, even in the ICU, after an injury or an illness. And this can be achieved with working together with the different teams and ordering therapies right away. Oftentimes in hip fracture patients, they're getting people up on the same day or at the latest the next day following a hip fracture procedure. It's important for social workers. Sometimes when we think about discharge planning, we think about the social worker maybe coming in later in the hospital course to talk about discharge. But most centers nowadays have the social worker right up front, right after admission, starting to look at discharge options or discharge needs at the very beginning of the hospital course. And that's to map out, is this patient going to be able to go home with services? Will they be able to just go home with family? Will they need a pit stop to a skilled nursing facility, and to plan for these in advance? So the other key part of a geriatric fracture center is early surgical intervention. We're going to talk about that. It's kind of a hot topic among fracturologists, hip fracturologists, I guess. And so we'll get to that later, but we'll just note that in any good fracture program, there is continuous quality improvement, which means that there is somebody looking at the numbers and saying, how many people with hip fractures did we treat? How old were they? Did they have any complications? How long was their hospital stay? Did we get them home as functional as possible? Were they readmitted maybe 2 weeks down the line with problems related to their hip fracture? So it's really important for not only the program to exist, but to also look back and see how well your program is doing and make the tweaks that are important to continue improvement. So why would a hospital embark on such an activity to have either a fracture center or an enhanced care program? Number one, you want to facilitate early surgery. We're going to talk about that in just a second. We want to start mobilization early because it's been shown to improve function and decrease hospital stays. We want to reduce morbidity, which is sort of complications, and mortality. We want to reduce somebody's length of stay in the hospital. The longer you stay in a hospital, the more apt you might be to get sick. And reduce cost of care is another thing, and also importantly, to reduce readmission rates. So it sounds like a slam dunk. This is something we should do, but why don't we do this? A lot of times, one of the biggest barriers is finding that champion, that clinical champion, or an orthopedic surgeon or a geriatrician, or the two of them together, or different departments who really want to champion this cause, because it is a lot of work pulling together a whole team that involves many different disciplines within the hospital. And because you're pulling together that team and there's time involved in planning and there's the need for resources to be present to do this, it costs a lot of money. So you have to also have the buy-in and support of hospital administrators. And then in the end, you want to say, if we're going to expend all this money to make sure there's a cardiologist available, to make sure that there's an anesthesiologist available when we need it, to open up an extra operating room in case somebody has a hip fracture, you really want to know, does this kind of a program work in the end? Is it effective? So in 2009, there was a study that took a look at co-management of patients, co-managed between an orthopedic surgeon and a geriatrician at a fracture center to look at short-term hip fracture outcomes. So what they did was they looked at 193 patients who were admitted to their center where they had developed a fracture center kind of model of care, and then a bunch of other different patients that were admitted to another hospital and compared how they did. And they compared, so just two different hospitals, and they found that time to surgery was less in the fracture center model. The postoperative infections were less in the post-fracture model. Complications were less, and physical restraints, there was none in the fracture center model. Sounds pretty good. Well, it didn't sound good for the people who were in the other hospital. It sounds pretty good for the people who were in the fracture center hospital. But as usual, we always have to think about, is this really good evidence for us to make the investment in a fracture center? So sounds good. Here are the study limitations. One of the study limitations is you looked at the records back in time. So you didn't follow people, like you didn't follow Joe and how his hospital course went. You went to medical records, so there's no people looking at anybody. You reviewed the medical records from people in two different hospitals. So they have different systems of care in each of the hospitals. Is it really like comparing apples and oranges between the two hospitals in addition to comparing one with a program and one with another? The people who reviewed the records, did they have a bias because they kind of knew who was in the fracture care group? It was hard to determine whether delirium was present by looking at the records, so it wasn't clear if this was a complication of what. The outcomes were measured in the short term, so we don't know what happened to Mrs. Smith 3 months down, 6 months down the line in terms of her function. And so basically you need what we call more prospective studies to evaluate efficacy of a program like this, which basically means instead of looking backwards in time and reviewing records, we want to say, okay, we're going to admit you to the program, we're going to admit you to usual care, we're going to admit you to the program, we're going to admit you to usual care, and then kind of review how people did from then prospectively. So they kind of did that. This is a study that came out about 4 or 5 years later. They did a prospective randomized control trial, which means they did exactly that. They said, you go to this, we're admitting you for hip fracture, you go here, you go here, you go here. And they randomized people. 198 people went to the accelerated care or the fracture model program. 199 went to the usual care program. And they found that patients receiving the specialized, accelerated, enhanced care improved mobility, activities of daily living, quality of life versus those who were in just the kind of conventional hospital program. Again, sounds pretty good. There's always study limitations in doing research, so I have to bring this up. The staff that are involved in the care and those who are assessing the medical records could tell which patient was in which cohort because it was kind of obvious. People who had protocols and who went quickly through the system were probably in the enhanced care model. It's also not clear with these results which one, two, or three of the components of the program made it the most effective in improving outcome. Was it the early surgery part? Was it the laboratory part? Was it the early mobilization part? Was it all of those parts? We really don't know what's contributing to the improved outcome. However, the important point is this study builds on current evidence that supports doing this kind of interdisciplinary care. Now there's early surgery, which is kind of a big topic. So what is early surgery? Current recommendations in some centers, and it's not 100% standard, is approximately 24 to 48 hours after a fracture. Even in some centers, 48 hours, they're not able to meet the needs. And that, I would assume that these would be places in more community or rural or smaller hospitals that just don't have the staff power, the MD power to get it going. So they looked at timing. So what one study did is they wanted to look at all of the articles that may have possibly been related to timing of surgery and the effect of timing on surgery in patients with fractures. So they actually started out, their initial search came up with almost 2,000 articles. But as you can see at the very bottom, after taking out articles that weren't really as relevant, that didn't have the necessary information that they thought was important, that weren't very good quality, they only ended up with 16 studies that they could really, really use. So that's kind of how the whole evidence-based world works, is you have to look for the best kind of studies to review. So out of 2,000 articles or studies, they only had 16 to look at. But when they did look at it, they found that early surgery, and in their definition, it was between 24 and 72 hours, there was actually a decreased mortality, decreased risk of pneumonia, and reduced risk of pressure ulcers. So again, sounds pretty good. Sounds good. Of course, here we have study limitations. The analysis of the complications was limited to studies that included mortality rates. So if your study didn't really talk about mortality but did talk about complications, it wasn't included in the analysis. In addition, the patients who had delays in surgery tended to be the sicker patients, and so they inherently sort of had higher chances of having a complication in mortality. So it's hard to tease that little aspect out. And again, these studies were observational studies, which potentially could be prone to bias. So they took a look again and tried to say, okay, let's look at timing of surgery again. And this is the hip attack pilot trial. And the hip attack is kind of a buzz phrase that we're seeing more often. The reason they call it a hip attack is they're trying to note the importance of treating a hip fracture, especially in an elderly person, with the urgency that one might need to treat a heart attack. So this is a hip attack investigator group, and they're looking to see how feasible is it, especially for places that don't do surgery until 72 hours or 48 hours after fracture. How feasible is it to really push that time envelope and see if you can deliver surgery sooner? So they actually looked at doing that randomized design. Somebody has a hip fracture, you go to standard care. Somebody has a hip fracture, you go to the accelerated model, and so on and so forth. And they randomized people. And they actually found that with this whole fracture model and team model, you really could make an impact on decreasing the amount of time to surgery for individuals. And in their case, they kind of got down to an astounding median time of 6 hours, which is pretty doggone fast, super fast. Actually, that created a lot of controversy. So you see in the literature, it's like, really, 6 hours? You expect us to do 6 hours? I don't think they're really expecting to do 6 hours, but I think the point being is that you could really reduce the time of surgery if you embrace sort of this team model of care. Now, since it was a pilot study, they didn't have a whole lot of people that they recruited. So they didn't have what we call the numbers to really, a number of subjects to really make some definitive conclusions about the efficacy or the impact of having early surgery. But they think that they may have seen preliminary findings that major complications occurred within 30 days in those patients who were not admitted to the specialized hip fracture program. So their study started in 2014. The end of their study is in December 2018. So we're all looking forward to seeing what they come up with in terms of, hey, were you able to keep your time to surgery down? And then also, what real impact did it have on the patient outcomes? Again, we want to say we're still not sure what early surgery is. There is another study that just occurred was completed last year where they took a look at 30-day mortality in patients who underwent hip fracture surgery. So basically, this is in Canada. They looked back on data, so they weren't looking at people in person, but they looked back on over 40,000 cases of patients who had hip fractures in Canada, and they looked for the outcome of mortality within 30 days. And they found that increased wait time, in other words, time to surgery, increased your risk of mortality. Increased your risk of mortality, and that maybe the key hour that you see this increase in mortality occur is after 24 hours. So they're encouraging people to really try to get that surgery done within the first 24 hours. Again, study limitations. It's really a statistical thing here, very complex, but some of the medical complexity of the patients may have confounded some of their results. So there's always a caveat when you have studies to say, are your statistics sound, and could we account for all the different factors that may confound your statistics? However, these last two studies really add to the body of evidence that suggests that early surgery, perhaps within that 24 hours, may decrease the risk of complications and mortality. Take-home points, then. Undertaking a fracture-like a model of care or an enhanced care model or an accelerated care model, all of the same things, is a really resource-rich endeavor. In other words, it requires a lot of moving parts and a lot of parts that cost money that require clinical champions and hospital support. The thought is, though, maybe those investments can actually have a return with decreased length of stay, decreased morbidity, and decreased complication. A team approach can heighten awareness to the prevention of complications while somebody is in the hospital with you. A team approach has been shown to greatly reduce time to surgery. Timing appears really important. What that time frame exactly is and how that time frame can be assessed in somebody who's super medically complex is not quite clear yet. There is a growing body of evidence that this care can decrease complications and mortality. What we don't know are the long-term outcomes, like all of this effort that you put in on the front end and trying to get people to surgery early, try to prevent complications. How does that really impact a person's function 6 months, 12 months, or more down the line? So prospective studies, fortunately, are in the works to better determine what factors in care might be the most important to consider when treating patients with fractures. Thanks. That's it.
The question was, could I clarify sort of the studies that showed that higher rates of vitamin D increased risk of falls? Particularly it was with doses that were given, say, once a month intravenously. So these were, you know, basically taking like on the level of thousands of units of vitamin D and looking at patients that had were getting them sort of on a daily basis, and they showed that there was sort of a risk of increased falls with those particular patients. Right. So yeah. It was hard to really kind of tease out. I mean, there's so many moving parts with a lot of these studies, but sort of when they kind of controlled for all the different variables, it looked like these people that got the very high doses of vitamin D did have higher risk of falls. So I think the question was, is there any complications with nerve blockade for pain?
I can answer that. So nerve blockade for pain, actually, it's to our knowledge, I haven't seen a lot of literature on problems with it in hip fracture. I'm trying to think of other potential reasons why you would have difficulty with nerve blockade. I think it's really effective, and it's monitored closely by anesthesiologists who do them. I don't know what the incidence of nerve damage is related to the actual blockade, but for the most part, a lot of patients, particularly, let's say, for example, arthroplasty patients, get nerve blockade post-surgery, and it seems to be very effective.
And just to add to that, they've shown that they've been able to reduce sort of the opioid intake significantly, obviously, with these nerve blocks. So I think taking that into account really, points to the benefits. Yeah. So the question is, if you fall outside, how do you sort of do it safely or help prevent injury? So I didn't look into it in depth, but I think some of the topics are sort of try and keep your body bent. If you fall, one physical therapist mentioned sort of trying to fall on the meat, so try to avoid sort of bony prominences. And I think those are sort of the main things. But honestly, I think most falls really did happen indoors. The ones that happened outside were usually when usually more active adults that were walking really fast. So I would say if you're still pretty active, monitoring sort of your walking speed and being careful of your environmental barriers is important.
There are some, I know of at least one, and it escapes me as to the name of the program. There is a community resource where they actually teach people how to fall. So just FYI, you might Google something like that. And I know there is a program here in San Francisco that does that.
So the question is, any special exercise for peripheral neuropathy or Charcot-Marie-Tooth, which is a nerve injury from the periphery affected starting from the feet. So usually peripheral neuropathy is in the United States in the diabetes, alcoholic, and some kind of a medication such as a cancer medication could cause it. Also, we don't know the reason, just simply aging process could cause a peripheral polyneuropathy. So in that case, so you feel probably a little bit weird feeling or maybe sometimes numbness, tingling, or burning feeling. So when you stand up, so you don't feel much about floor feeling, so that you feel unstable when you walk, even in the flat level. And also, you don't feel like any incline, like when you foot on the grass or those things, you don't feel it. So you get injured and get infected. In that case, you need to, the couple of things is when you rub and rub by hand or other textures to keep on the feeling. That is number one. Number two is you need to examine the foot every day to check if you don't injured or not. Number three recommendation is change the shoes for the couple of pair of shoes, because of the every shoe is a different feeling and a different weight bearing. So if you put on the one shoe for the all the way through, you may weight bear for the one part of the feet or those things that get injured. So you need to rotate the shoes. That is you feel the different, and your weight bearing is your pressure point is changed. That is important things.
I didn't see any specific studies on type of exercises, but I think doing things actually that would focus more on, so we call it proprioception, basically knowing where your body is in space. I think doing a lot of more of, say, like the yoga or the tai chi with balance and being able to go through those movements would be more helpful. But I didn't see any specific studies.
Yeah. So the comment is that it's important to keep to note that the patient is really important in the process of consenting, making sure that things are going to go forward, because there's different. If I'm paraphrasing this correctly, there are different factors like authorizations and insurance issues that come to light. Sometimes, we are stymied by either a patient who is unable to do that for us or a family member who's not readily available. Most centers, however, since this would be considered an emergency, kind of just go ahead and do what needs to be done. But you're right. History, knowing about family history, what's going on at home, and facilitating the decision-making process in somebody who may not be 100% awake or with the program at the time is very critical. Yeah.
Right. So the question was sort of how fear of falling can influence risk of falls and things that can help prevent that. So I think that's where the exercise really, they showed that doing these sort of even especially group-based exercises really helped reduce fear of falling. And really when someone has a fall, obviously they're afraid of it happening again, but that can lead to increased inactivity, not going outside, doing the activities they like, engaging in even social activities or going to doing normal things that will keep them moving, like we mentioned with exercise. So that was sort of how a fall, having one fall puts you at increased risk of another fall, and then a lot of that can be attributed to the fear and how that affects your behavior, and then you're not moving as much. Yeah, from the literature, it was mostly on the exercise because really, I mean, and a lot of them are led by physical therapists, so they're really going through sort of what to do if you fall, sort of, and they're going through lots of exercises where you're kind of feeling your body through these movements that kind of help, reduce the fear. But they didn't really mention any specific sort of like psychological interventions, things like that.
The question was, what is WBAT? It was an acronym that I had on one of my slides that slipped in there. So basically, it means weight bearers tolerated, and I think it was on a slide that referred to early mobilization and making sure that once you're cleared to weight bear, that the orthopedic surgeon, says, go ahead and weight bear, that we're getting you up and onto your limb. Even if you're not weight bearing for whatever reason, let's say it was a complicated hip repair, we still want to get people up, and the therapists are skilled at knowing not how to get people up, but not putting weight on the leg, but basically mobilizing on day one.
Yeah, the question is are there any symptoms that you can monitor for to identify if you're losing bone density? So unfortunately, not that I'm aware of, there's not a lot of physical signs, but there are risk factors for, so osteoporosis or low bone density, so older age, certain ethnicities, the decreased vitamin D level, inactivity, so not doing a lot of like weight-bearing activities. But really, unfortunately, sometimes the first time you find out you have low bone density or osteoporosis is with a fracture or a fall. Yeah, yeah. Oh, the question is, can your doctor check your bone density? Yeah, so they can also just check for levels, say, of your vitamin D and your calcium, and that helps give a sense. And then also there's certain tests, even with x-rays, you can get a sense on how the bone looks on an x-ray if there's less density. And then really the formal screening is the DEXA scan that your usually primary care doctors would consider ordering, usually at a certain age. This is not really our bread and butter. The question is there a certain age? I mean, there's certain medications, too, that, say, if you take steroids, other certain types of medications, I can't think of, thyroid medications that put you at higher risk. So really, there's a lot of factors. So I think that the age does depend on each person. I don't know if you know.
Yeah. Diagnosis as well. We work with a lot of spinal cord injured patients, for example. We may be getting DEXA scans on them earlier because they tend to be prone to fragility fractures by not weight bearing. So it all kind of depends on the whole picture as well. What are the pros and cons of all the different bisphosphonates, medications that are used with osteoporosis that bone health doctors or your primary care doctors may be putting you on? We actually aren't the first ones that necessarily prescribe it here, so I don't think I can give you, or I'm looking at my colleagues, information particularly regarding bone density, because it's a very complicated field. And there are actually here at UCSF, we have the skeletal health clinic, which really goes in depth into trying to figure out what your risk is given your bone density, how they're going to diagnose it or evaluate, and what medications they may be putting somebody on, and what the pros and cons are depending on what your particular DEXA may look like or what other medications you might be on or your age. So I think we're going to probably defer that question, and maybe we can get back to you on general guidelines regarding that. But for us, we're generally not probably as well versed in looking at bone density given our current specialties. That's a really good question. A standing frame, he's referring to a standing frame that spinal cord injured patients use in order to, oftentimes they're hydraulic frames, so you roll your wheelchair up to a frame, you're in a harness, you do a pumping up of a hydraulic lift, and then it moves you into a standing position. And one of the questions, the question is, how does that really affect your bone density? I think intuitively we think that it may certainly help to improve because you're weight bearing your bone stock or your bone health. I don't think that there's been a lot of prospective randomized studies to show exactly how much it improves and prevents fractures in the future. But intuitively, we think that standing, just in general, because we talk about standing here, is really important. But we haven't seen any literature that looks specifically at that population in big numbers to tell you 100% for sure what the benefits are.
The question is, DEXA scan is of the hip. They actually look at, DEXA scans also look at your bones in your back, hip, and usually they do another extremity as well to get a sense of your bone density. So it's not just the hip. They'll look at like a vertebral body or one of the bones in the back as well. And then I think also one in the upper extremity. The question is, you might have increased, say, fragility in your hand versus in your hip. And I do believe you're correct. So I think, I think in terms of risks and what we're really looking for, probably the major bones that we're looking for are the hip and the femur, because those are obviously major complications if you have a fracture in one of them. The question is, what is a physiatrist? We hear this all the time, so it's physiatry. Yeah, PHYSIATRY, also known as physical medicine and rehab, and that's what all three of us are. But we all, we're MDs. It's a specialty, a medical specialty, but really I like to describe it as a hodgepodge of sort of non-surgical orthopedics, kind of functional neurology, and we're sort of really well versed in, say, musculoskeletal medicine and neuromuscular diseases. So if you've lost your function, whether it was from a sports injury, a stroke, spinal cord injury, that's how people fit into our specialty. We try and help improve function. So we work really closely with, say, a lot of the physical therapists, occupational therapists, and our sort of team leaders for the rehab team. So she was mentioning how when she gets on a bus or is going up and down stairs, she's always tripping. So, you know, I mean, a lot of it might be, and I think also with women, too, that I was reading, is that we tend to have decreased strength in the lower extremities. And at least with falls, they've shown that people have lower strength in, say, picking up the foot or kind of extending the knee were associated with fractures, with falls. But, you know, so, I mean, as we get older, sort of, we definitely do lose strength in our legs. So that might be playing a part. As Dr. Nagao was mentioning, if you have lost sensation or even, you know, whether it's diabetes or maybe it's just the aging process, if you have lost some sort of sensation in your legs that might not be very obvious, that can definitely affect how you're moving, and maybe you're not able to pick your foot up, you know, maybe as well as you did 10 years ago, sort of. You're kind of not able, you don't have the right sense of where your foot is in space as it used to be, which happens with the normal aging process too.
So the question is, if you are 80 years old, can we get the build up of muscle mass? That's the question, right? So yes or no? Yes means like a young guy doing a high repetitive muscle training, probably elderly people cannot get it. But as I showed the slide, the function level is declining. That is depends on the muscle strength, balancing, every factors contribute. So one of the muscle factor is declining, for the curvature declining is probably slowed down by aging. So if you don't do the exercise and you're like a kind of downhill for the muscle strength, that is a risk of falling or injured. But if you do the exercise, even you don't realize you get exercise, even aging, you may be declining, but the declining slope is slowed down. So that it still have time to do some exercise. That is very important part. Even you cannot improve the muscle strength or muscle mass, you can maintain the muscle mass. Yes, it is. So if you do the exercises, so it's you can do by yourself or a supervised exercise. That is you need. It is very important to keep on maintain the muscle mass. That is true. So that is for the exercise. It's very difficult to solely get the muscle mass strength. That is including maybe stretching and balancing exercise as well. So if you try to do the muscle mass exercise, that is build up balancing or flexibility. Everything is going up. Question is, I personally doing an exercise. Yes, I do. So I do walking. I'm kind of a middle age already. So I have if I do some hard exercise, I have a knee pain. So I do walking and some using my body like a push up or those things. So I do by myself. So three to four times a week. I try. Thank you for the question.
That was our last question. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask us, feel free to come on up. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to speak with you today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.